This week's shir, we're now in the Sefer Shmot, and the truth is, the shir that I'd like to give today for Parshat Shmot could be given for many different parshiot in the Torah. I could have given this shir or something very similar to it on Parshat Vayishlach, on Parshat Toldot, or we could have this discussion perhaps at least when learning Parshat Balak in Sefer Bamidbar. Maybe Parshat Pinchas. Or if we were studying Tanakh, there are other places we could discuss the exact same topic. We could certainly discuss it in the context of Megillat Esther, perhaps in the book, context of the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. Or, if we weren't studying Torah texts, but if we were studying Jewish history, and we were studying the period of Bayit Sheni, we could discuss this topic, the very same discussion that we're going to have now. Or the period after Bayit Sheni, let's say the Roman period. Or if we were learning the Middle Ages, or if we were studying 19th and 20th century history, or for that matter, if we were discussing current events and trying to analyze current events, we could also have the same discussion. Because there is a phenomenon that the Torah addresses in at least the places that I just mentioned, and there are probably others. And it's a phenomenon that repeats itself over and over and over again, pretty much wherever Am Yisrael finds itself, any time or place. Where Am Yisrael has existed, where Jews have lived in any significant numbers for any significant period of time, the phenomenon has surfaced. A modern term for it, a term that dates back only to the 19th century, is anti-Semitism. It's a term that was actually invented by anti-Semites themselves. It's a term that's not exactly accurate either. Hatred of the Jew, opposition to the Jew. And what's so important or so unique about this phenomenon and about looking at the phenomenon, and what many people don't realize when they look at the phenomenon, is that hatred of the Jew is a unique phenomenon. It is unlike anything else. Now, it's not that we're the only people that have been hated. We are far from the only people to suffer from hatred, from persecution based on hatred, bias, discrimination, or any other word you might want to use for it. And what complicates matters, by the way, is that those who hate us also often hate other groups, so that it's often easy to see hatred of the Jew in the context of a broader phenomenon. And although it has something to do with that broader phenomenon, it is absolutely unique. And perhaps the best way to see that is to see the way history repeats itself in such striking ways. And since I could point to texts from any of those places, maybe we'll look at a few of them, but since we're doing Parshat Shmot, so let's start in Parshat Shmot. From the very beginning. Ve'ele Shmot b'nei Yisrael abayim Mitzrayma et Yaakov ishu ve'tovah Ruven Shimon Levi Yehuda Yisachar Zvulun uVinyamin Dan v'Naftali Gad v'Asher Vahi kol nefesh yotzei yerech Yaakov shivim nafesh ve'yosef haya b'mitzrayim. Sefer Shmot begins by recounting, summarizing, if you will, almost by quoting a pasuk that appeared at the end of Sefer Bereishit, and recounting the great historic event that was described at the end of the book of Bereishit, which is the descent of the family. And that's what we're talking about at this point. We're talking about a family. They're called B'nai Yisrael. A large family, a clan, if you'd like. Not even large enough to be called a tribe. 70 people. Sach HaKol, we're talking about a man and his 12 or 13 children, and their descendants, some grandchildren. And they came down to Mitzrayim, 70 people. And then time passed. Vayamot Yosef, as we read at the very end of last week's parsha, Vayamot Yosef v'chol echav v'chol hador hahu. That entire generation, the entire generation of those who came to Mitzrayim passed. Anyone who's in Mitzrayim now is a new generation, those who were born already there, those who never knew life in Eretz Canaan. And not only were all those who came down to Mitzrayim gone, but Yosef was gone. And that's, of course, very significant. Because if we're talking about the family of Yaakov living in a foreign land, they had been brought there and invited there by Yosef, who was a great leader, the Mishneh LaMelech, and the king himself, Paro, had invited them down to Mitzrayim. And as long as Yosef was alive, they had what we call today, protekcia, right? They had somebody in a very high position. But that's gone now. And something else happened. Perhaps precisely at that moment that they may begin to feel more vulnerable, for whatever reason, Uvnei Yisrael paru vayishritzu vayirbu vayatzmu bimod me'od batim alei ha'aretz otam. The entire world became filled, the entire land became filled with them. Of course, that's an exaggeration, that's a metaphor, but they had many, many, many descendants, and they became already a very, very, very large multitude. And this, of course, the young ladies who were at my house a few weeks ago, we talked about this. This, of course, is related to the nevuah that Yaakov Avinu had received when he stopped at Be'er Sheva on the way down to Mitzrayim. That's in Parshat Vayigash. On the way down to Mitzrayim, Yaakov had paused in Be'er Sheva. It's the beginning of Perek Memvav in Sefer Bereshit. Vayisa Yisrael v'chol ha'shalom v'yavo be'er Sheva v'yizbach zvachim l'elokei aviv Yitzchak. He stopped in Be'er Sheva on the way down to Mitzrayim. In my house, we talked about why he dafka stopped there. But he received there a prophecy. Vayomer Elokim liYisrael b'marot halayla. And he said to him, Al tira mirda Mitzrayma ki legoi gadol asimcha sham. He said to Yaakov that although there's much to fear in Mitzrayim, something great is going to happen in Mitzrayim, and that is that you're going to become a nation. That promise that was given originally to Avram Avinu, which I believe we talked about here back in Parshat Lech Lecha, I think it was the first shiur this year. We talked about the promise of Ve'escha legoi gadol. You're going to be a great nation. That's what Hashem told Avraham. That promise was not fulfilled in Avraham's lifetime, nor in Yitzchak's, nor in Yaakov's. It remains a future vision. And Yaakov, on his way down to Mitzrayim, was told that's going to happen in Mitzrayim. And indeed, it did. We just read how Bnei Yisrael multiplied and are no longer really, it's no longer really correct to refer to them by the term Bnei Yisrael. We need a different term. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. Pasuk Chet tells us, Vayakom melech chadash al Mitzrayim asher lo yadat Yosef. Rashi tells us that there are two opinions here. Is this actually a melech chadash? Is it a new generation? Is it really a new king? Everyone else died. The king also died, and now it's a new generation completely. Or perhaps, Rak asa atzmo ki'ilu chadash. Perhaps the original king was still alive. He had outlived everyone else. But once Yosef was gone, he made it as if he was a new king. No longer paid attention. Conveniently forgot all the wonderful things that Yosef had done. Remember, Yosef was a hero in Mitzrayim. He saved the country from destruction, first of all. There was a famine. 7 years, that could have destroyed the country. Not only did Yosef save Mitzrayim, but he built up the power of... It's worthwhile studying carefully those psukim there in Parshat Miketz that discuss the way in which Yosef took over the economy of Mitzrayim, the way he completely restructured. I don't know if it was good for the Egyptian people, but it was certainly good for the government. He basically consolidated a lot of wealth and a lot of power in the hands of Paro. So he saved the country from destruction, built the country into power. You see that people from all over, people from Canaan, had to go there and buy food in the time of a famine. And particularly the king owed a lot of personal gratitude to Yosef, who also strengthened the power of the royalty. But now we have a Melech Chadash, actual or metaphoric, Shelo Yadat Yosef. Vayomer el amo, hine am b'nei Yisrael rav v'atzum mimenu. And that's the very first time that we're suddenly referred to as am. It's still called am b'nei Yisrael. Later on it'll be am Yisrael. Right now it's still called am b'nei Yisrael. But the very first time that the word nation is used is here, which is exactly what Yaakov was told. L'goy gadol asim chasham. There you're going to become a nation. So what we're looking at right now is the very dawn, the very birth of the Jewish people. The moment that a nation called Am Yisrael comes into existence. And the very first time that that word is used, what's the context? Immediately. The context is opposition, suspicion, and perhaps even hatred. Vayomer el amo, he said to his people, referring to the king Paro, Hine am b'nei Yisrael rav v'atzum mimenu. They are very, very numerous. Some translate this as they are more numerous than we are. Nechama Leibovitz points out that that is almost definitely not a correct translation. If it is a correct translation of the words, then it's obviously an exaggeration. There's no way that the descendants of Yaakov at this point were more numerous than the Egyptian people. So either Paro was simply exaggerating, or perhaps Nechama Leibovitz suggests, perhaps the pasuk should be translated a little differently. Not they are... Rav v'atzumi menu, not that they are more numerous and more powerful than we are, but they are more numerous, they are too numerous and powerful for us. meaning this is more than we can tolerate. This is not to our liking. And therefore, hava nitchak malo. Let's act wisely. Let's act cunningly. Let's work out a plan here. Why? Pen yirbe, lest they continue to multiply. V'nosaf gam hu al soneinu v'nilcham banu v'yalam in haaretz. Lest, if we don't do something, says Paro to his people, they're going to continue to multiply and multiply and multiply. There will be many of them. And what's going to happen? V'nosaf gam hu al soneinu. They're going to become what we call a fifth column. One day there'll be a war. Vayat ki tikrena milchama. V'nilcham banu. What's going to happen? At some point, someone's going to attack us. Some foreign power. And those among us, B'nai Yisrael, are not going to be loyal to Mitzrayim, but rather they will join with the enemy. Minosaf gamhu al soneinu. They'll join with the enemy. And then we're going to have to fight an enemy without, an enemy within. And because of that fifth column, they'll defeat us. Ve'alam in haaretz either means literally, and then they'll leave. After destroying the country, they'll just leave. Or Rashi reads it based on the Midrash as they'll force us to leave. They'll drive us, they're going to take over the country. So we have here from the very first moment that there's what we would call today a Jewish community. The term Jewish, of course, in this context is an oxymoron. But if you want, you can use the term Am Yisrael. The very moment that a Jewish community or an Israeli community comes into existence, there's suspicion. We can't trust these people. They have other loyalties. And therefore, we have to do something. And we have to institute a series of laws or measures to protect ourselves against them. And it has to be done with chokhmah. It has to be done in a calculated, careful, intelligent way. And in fact, that's what happened. By Yasimu alav sarei misim l'man anoto b'sivvotam, v'yiven arei miskenot l'faro et pitom betram. Says a gradual process is described here of enslavery, and they had to build these cities for Paro. But of course, Paro's plan backfires. V'chasher ya'anu oto ken yirbe v'chen yifrotz. And Rashi quotes here the beautiful midrash. There's a very wonderful play on words here. And says, what did Paro say to his people? Pen yirbe, lest the nation of Israel multiply tremendously. And here it says, v'chasher ya'anu oto, ken yirbe v'chen yifrot. So the Midrash quotes as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu responded, ata omer pen yirbe, ani omer ken yirbe. That's beautiful. Little play on words here. Everything backfires, and more and more and more, exactly what he tries to do, the opposite happens. But that doesn't mean, meaning, if his attempt was to eradicate, or at least to put down and somehow control Am Yisrael, that backfires. But that doesn't mean the plan of those who tried to wipe us out backfires. But that doesn't mean that Am Yisrael has things good. No. Vayavidu Mitzrayim et Bnei Yisrael b'farech. Right? And every year on Pesach at the Seder, we eat bitter herbs to remember this. Maror, to remember. And then things get worse. Then we already have the command to the miyaldot, right? To the midwives, to kill the children secretly. And that backfires because they refuse to cooperate. There's a machloket whether those miyaldot, by the way, were Jewish or were Egyptian. But either way, they were heroes in every sense of the word. They risked their own lives to do what's right and not to kill innocent babies. And so then, finally, this ends with Vayitzav Paro, Pasuk Chabed already, Vayitzav Paro, L'chol Amo Lemor, Kol Abein Hayilod Hayaora Tashlichu. That he makes a command now for everyone to kill the babies, not just the Me'adot. This phenomenon repeats itself with all these elements, again and again and again in Jewish history. There are times that it's repeated exactly, and there are times that it plays out a little differently, but the general phenomenon is there. And if you want to see this, I'll tell you what strikes me most, is the Ramban's interpretation of these psukim. And let me just read you a short passage from the Ramban, And you'll tell me if you think of the same things that I think of when I read this Ramban. The Ramban is a little bit bothered by that expression, Hava nitchak malo. We have to work cleverly here. We have to do something very, very intelligent. What's the need for Paro, after all, is the leader of the most powerful nation, maybe the most powerful nation in the world, certainly the regional superpower for sure. He's dealing with a group of people who came there as shepherds, no weapons, no foreign government that's going to come to their disposal. What exactly is he worried about? If he wants to do whatever he could just round them all up and put them in jail or kill them or do whatever he wants or enslave them. What? Why the need for Hava Nitchak Malo? Listen to the way the Ramban interprets these psukim. The Ramban, there's a number of chidushim here. The Ramban interprets things in order to explain it a little differently than it may sound. But like I said, tell me if you think of the same thing I think of when we read the Ramban here. Hava Nitchak Malo. Lo ra'a Paro b'chachmeyo atzav lahakotam b'cheret. Paro didn't want to simply go and just kill them all. What was he worried about? Ki tiyeh b'gida gidola lahakot chinam ha'am asher ba'o ba'aretz b'mitzvat ha'melech harishon. First of all, he didn't want to look. That would be completely immoral. You can't go ahead and just, these people were invited to Egypt by his predecessor, and now he's going to just kill them all for no reason? That looks really very, very bad. So he has to create, he has to change the mentality about these people, so he has to give himself legitimization to do it. That's his first concern. And also, v'gam am ha'aretz lo yitnu reshut la'melech lasot chamas kazeh. He's also afraid that if he acts in such a way, if he just goes and massacres innocent people, he's afraid that his own nation is going to stand up to him. People are going to say, this is immoral, we don't do that. They may be Egyptians, they may be idolaters, they may be whatever they are, but there's a certain human compassion. People don't just... He's worried that he's going to face a rebellion among his own people if he does things like that. In other words, the Hava Nitchak Malo, according to Rambam, was not said to... It says here, Vayomer El Amo, but that doesn't mean he said it to the people in this way. He consulted with his inner advisors, perhaps. And what he said to his people was a little bit different. V'af ki b'nei Yisrael am rav v'atzum v'yasu yimahem milchama gedola. And not only that, but the Jewish people, if he goes out, or B'nai Yisrael, if he goes out and tries to just massacre them, they're going to resist. They're going to fight back. They're not going to just let themselves be slaughtered. Now, assumedly, they're no match for Paro's armies. He's not concerned that he's going to be defeated militarily, but it's going to be a balagan. There's going to be bloodshed, and he might lose some soldiers, and then they might... Uyustabech. So therefore... he decides to... That's the reason for the Hava Nitchak Malo. Therefore, Paro decides to operate a little bit more surreptitiously. So what does he do? V'lachem... Now, here's the part where I want you to tell me if you're thinking what I'm thinking. V'lachem hitil b'hem... Aval Amar, so therefore he says, she'aseh derech chokhma, that we have to operate cleverly. Shelo yargishu Yisrael. He wanted to make sure that Am Yisrael didn't realize that what was being done was motivated by enmity. He started with a tax, special tax for Jews. That's mikubal, certainly in the old days. In ancient times, you have foreigners living in a country, they have to pay extra taxes. And the acharkach, then, Sivad Baseter, he commanded secretly the Mialdot, La'arog HaZcharim Al Ha'avnayim. He commanded the Mialdot, the midwives, secretly to kill the male children, but to do it in such a way that it wouldn't be clear what happened. Vafilu HaYoldot Atzman Lo Yedu Bahem. To kill the children in such a way that even the mothers wouldn't realize what happened. The command to the Mialdot was to kill the children secretly and then to tell the mother, I'm very, very sorry, but your child, tragically, your child is dead. And the mother will think that it's simply a terrible, terrible accident, a death at childbirth, whatever. And then, And then v'acharei chen tziva lechol amo, then he told his people, kol haben ha'ilod ha'ya'ora tashlichu. Finally, when he made the command to kill all, told everyone to throw all the children into the river, according to Ramban, ha'inyan shelo ratzal letzavot b'sarei ha'tabachim asher lo lahargam b'cherev. The Ramban understands that he didn't want to tell the people to actually just go out and slaughter them openly. B'cherev ha'melech, o she'yashlichu heim otam lior, aval amar la'am kasher yimtza kol echad yelid yehudi, yashlichu oto b'yor. According to Ramban, it wasn't the command of kol ha'ben ha'yilod ha'ya'ora tashlichu, wasn't what it sounds like, which is that he made a proclamation, right? A law, and announced to all the people, anybody who sees a Jewish child, throw it in the river. That's not what happened. But rather, he let it be known through back channels that anyone who could find a Jewish child in a vulnerable state should throw him in the river. But not that the king's officially taking responsibility for that. So one can imagine that there was every so often a Jewish little child who was playing near the river or something, and suddenly the child was found having drowned. And if the parent of the child would realize what happened and complain to the king, he would complain to the king or to the mayor of the city or whatever, that they would have a trial, and he would say, bring witnesses, and of course he would make sure that the trial always worked out in favor of, and the, you know, no one would ever be convicted for this. And after this was going on for a while, eventually, the Egyptians got the idea that you can do what you want to Am Yisrael, nothing's going to happen. After a number of these show trials, and it became clear that whoever throws a Jewish baby in the river, nothing happens. So the Egyptians sort of got the point. And all of a sudden, they would attack the Jewish homes. They would break into the Jewish homes at night. Spontaneous outbursts of violence, unexpected by the government, and the government just happens to not be able to put the rioting down so quickly. And that, according to the Ramban, is the explanation. When we're told about the birth of Moshe, his mother, knowing what was going on, hid him for 3 months, but then v'lo yachla od hatzvino. She couldn't hide him any longer because it was already getting to the point that the Egyptians were breaking into their homes at night and there was no police to speak to, there was no protection whatsoever, and the Am Yisrael found themselves very vulnerable. And then the Ramban goes on and he suggests, so the Ramban has a whole different way of reading this. According to Ramban, it's not what it sounds like, that the king issued all these decrees, but rather, he realized that that's not the way to do it, so he acted. That's what Havanit Chakmalo means. He didn't make any public statements. But first, he gave them a tax. Not a monetary tax, but they had to work for him. And of course, when they're working for him, he's always able to claim that they're not working hard enough. And slowly and carefully, he converted them from simply people that had been drafted into the royal service into slaves. And he starts, behind the scenes, inciting to violence against the Jews, makes it work out in such a way that the perpetrators are never punished, that people slowly get the point, and eventually the people begin to realize that they can, I mean, we get this constant image of propaganda and of attacks that are tolerated by the government, and eventually a so-called spontaneous outburst of violence where the people rise up, and it seems that perhaps the government might have instigated, but the government says, no, we don't know what's going on. I'll pause the Ramban here. I want to make one more comment about the Ramban, but what does this sound like? This sounds like Germany in the 1930s, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Right? First we have propaganda, then we have Nuremberg laws, and all kinds of things, a little bit here, a little bit there, and then boom, there's a Kristallnacht, right? Now, this is the Ramban 700 years before Kristallnacht, roughly, reading an interpretation into a text that's written thousands of years earlier that sounds to me, if somebody would sit here today and write this Perush, maybe we could say, okay, what are you doing? You're reading the Tanakh based on your Now maybe that's because the Ramban himself experienced something like that, and that's what he was reading back into the text. But if that's so, if we can read something else into the text, then I think it makes the point very nicely. The Ramban then continues. Ramban thinks that at a certain point, and this doesn't work with Nazi Germany, but it does work with some of the other incidents, that it must have spun out of control, and really Paro realized that that things are out of control, and then he canceled that the Ramban figures out when Moshe was 3 years younger than Aharon. It seems that when Aharon was born, there was no such decree. So the decrees must have happened during that period between the birth of Aharon and the birth of Moshe. But it also seems that shortly afterwards, the decrees were over as well. So perhaps the king realized that things were spiraling out of control, and he had to pull back. And the fact that when people try to use these types of techniques against us, it has the danger of spiraling out of control and can blow up in their own faces. I think we can just look at the newspapers today and see how that sort of thing is playing out. So here's a great example of how we can look at an event that took place, again, at the very moment that Am Yisrael came into existence, that the Ramban can look at a couple of thousand years later and write about it in ways that may have mirrored his own experiences. And we can look at it and see very recent history almost exactly playing itself out in the same way. There are other examples as well where we see these sort of universal phenomena. And this is what I mean when I say that hatred of the Jew is so unique, is that it's not that we're the only people to be hated, but there are certain phenomena that first of all seem to happen again and again and again in the exact same way, and at times in ways that defy logic. What do I mean, defy logic? So here I'll once again quote Nechama Leibovitz, who made the following comment about Pesukim that we looked at briefly in Parshat Toldot from a slightly different angle. Let's just take a quick look back at Bereishit Perek Chavav. Even before there's such a thing as Am Yisrael, we're talking here simply about Yitzchak Avinu. But Yitzchak Avinu, as we know, there was a famine in his time also, and he went and settled among the Plishtim. And we're told, Perek Chava, Pasuk Yubed, Vayizra Yitzchak Ba'aretz Ahi. So Yitzchak is living among the Plishtim. Vayimtza B'shana Ahi Me'ash She'arim Vayivarecheu Hashem. Yitzchak plants a farm and he becomes very successful. Vayigdal Ha'ish Vayelech Haloch V'gadel Ad Ki Gadal Miod. He becomes very, very wealthy, very successful. And that generates resentment. It says, "Vayhilo miknetzon, mikne bakar, vavudar rabba." He has lots of animals. He's very wealthy. "Vayikanu otoplishtim, the plishtim resent him." "V'chol habeirot." This is the pasuk we looked at from a different angle. "V'chol habeirot asher chafru avdei aviv bimei Avraham aviv sitmum plishtim vayimalum afar." The plishtim Avraham, Yitzchak's father, had dug wells. Wells in the desert are an extremely important thing. You can't live without them. There's no water in the desert, right? It doesn't rain. It doesn't rain very much, right? But if you are able to find the right places to dig and get to the groundwater underneath, you can live in the desert. These are extremely bad. It's a source of life, literally. The Nechama Leibovitz points out that it says somewhere around here, where the pasuk is, that they found a be'er mayim chayim, right? They found a well of living water, water of life. And the plishtim, because they were jealous of Yitzchak, what did they do? They stuffed up the wells and just, not they stole them. That I would understand. I would understand if they're jealous of him. He's very successful. He's vulnerable. So they chase him out and take the wells and take the animals, take his money. I wouldn't justify it, but I would understand that. That's normal, unfortunately, normal human behavior sometimes. When people don't have moral restrictions, so then they'll do something like that. But here they're acting not against him, but against themselves as well. They simply destroy the wells. And they fill them up and they cover them up so that they're... And then we talked about how Yitzchak went and redug the same wells and did it. But what could possibly motivate people to do such a thing? And when I read these, psukim, I think about much more contemporary people, different people entirely, but who takes their name from the plishtim. Right? And we can quote our former foreign minister, Abba Iban, who famously once said about the Palestinians, right? They never lose a chance to miss an opportunity or something like that. Right? and that Abba Iban, who was this came from England, right? He was this Western European thinking Jew who was sure that there's a way to solve this problem because it's in the interest of both sides, and he couldn't understand how the hatred of Am Yisrael is so great that it caused them to act against their own interests, and they hurt themselves even more than they hurt us, but only if they can hurt us. It's illogical, it's irrational, but it's universal. We saw it. Yitzchak Avinu experienced it, we're experiencing it today, and I could give you examples from other places in history, in the Middle Ages. How many times in the Middle Ages were Jews expelled from countries in Europe where it might have been a situation of, right? The Jews very often in the Middle Ages, for whatever historic reasons, managed to amass a certain amount of wealth. And where on the one hand, there was perhaps a very short-term gain for the whatever ruler it is who could simply expel them from land and take their money. But immediately almost, the economy then collapses because the Jews had a certain economic function that they no longer were fulfilling. There were places in France, I think it was in the 13th century, the Jews were expelled three times. France or England? I believe it's France. The Jews were expelled three times. And within 100 years, which means that they were expelled, and then they realized, wait, we need these people, invite them back. The next generation expels them again, and invite them back. And unfortunately, why would they go back? Why would they go back? Because they didn't have any other options either, right? So exactly the same phenomenon, that on the one hand, those who try to destroy us, try to abuse us, try to take advantage of us, don't profit, but it doesn't necessarily help us either, yes?
You could also say about the Greeks who are obsessed with gaining knowledge and they love knowledge, but yet they still wanted to destroy the Torah because they knew that was what the Jews had.
100%. 100%. It's a universal phenomenon. The exact details play out differently. And there are other places in the Tanakh as well in which we can see things that that resonate very, very, very strongly to our modern ears. Maybe just one other. And then we'll turn to try to analyze it. But I feel like I cannot avoid simply pointing this one out as well. If you look at the book of Esther, and Haman also wanted to destroy us, and he was more bold than Paro. He didn't act wisely as Paro did, and perhaps that's part of what contributed to the failure of his plan. Right? He wanted to do it right away. Right? Genocide. No setting the stage. No propaganda. No slowly. Right? Just go straight for the But he had to. He had one obstacle in his path, and that is that he had to convince the king. He couldn't do it on his own. Technically, he wasn't the king. He was only a very high official. So I'm in Perek Gimel of Megillat Esther. Achar ha'dvarim ha'eleh gidal ha'melech ha'chashveyosh et Haman. And we know how everyone had to bow to him, and Mordechai refused, and this made Haman very angry. And it gets to the point in Pasuk Chet where Haman decides he's going to, he cast his pur, right? He cast his hagrala, his lottery, in order to determine the date. For whatever reason he did that, he came up with his plan. His plan is, Lashmid, Larogu, Labed, et Kol Yudim, Minar, Bad, Zakein, Tath, V'Nashim. Okay, which again, is a description that could be used exactly to describe the final solution. I mean, that's exactly what the final solution was supposed to be, right? Lashmid la'rogu la'beit et kol ha'yudim minar v'ad zakein taf v'nashim u'shlalam lavuz. And to also take their property. But he needs to get permission from the king. So how is he going to convince the king, HaMelech Achashverosh, how is he going to convince the king to agree to such a horrendous or horrific plan? And listen to what he says. Vayomer Haman la'melech Achashverosh. Yeshno am echad, mifuzar u'miforad bein ha'amim. First of all, that description. One nation, am echad, one nation, mifuzar u'miforad bein ha'amim. One nation scattered among the nations. First of all, can one think of a more eloquent, accurate description of what Am Yisrael is, and has been throughout history, since the exile. Am echad, mifuzar u'miforad bein ha'amim. So we could almost, if the pasuk ended there, we could almost take it, adopt it as a slogan, and as seriously, one nation, Am Echad, even though we are Mifuzar and Miforad. But what did he say? He then continues. B'chol medinot malchutecha, they're everywhere. V'dateihem shonot mikol. And by the way, and the description that they're everywhere is also true. I once looked into this, but pretty much the only countries in the world today that don't have a Jewish community, it's because they used to and they kicked us out. But I don't think there's a place in the world today that Jews have never lived. Like, there's no Jewish community in Saudi Arabia, but there once was, right? Some are very small communities, but... So, b'chol medinot malchutecha, v'dateihem shonot mikol am, their ways are different than the ways of all the other nations. V'et datei hamelech einam usim, they don't follow the king's laws. There is no indication that there was any truth to that statement other than that one single man, Mordechai, violated one single law about, or one single directive about bowing to Haman. But the concept that they don't follow the king's laws, there's no indication here that there was any truth to that statement, nor is there an indication that Haman brought any sort of evidence to back up this claim. And amazingly, I might have expected, if I didn't know what I was dealing with, I might have expected that such a request would be completely rejected out of hand, and that if not, having resulting in Haman losing his position or being in prison, or who knows what. What kind of irresponsible... Imagine, if you're the ruler of a country, and one of your officers comes with a suggestion, right? He says, I want you to know there's this people all over the place, and they're disloyal, we should kill all of them. You might ask for a commission of inquiry, you might ask for some evidence, let's look into this matter. He takes off the ring and hands it to him.
Money.
And no, not even. He tells him, you can keep the money. He promised him money. And
Achashverus...
He promised the king money.
Yeah, the king
Well, no, but the king didn't take it. He tells the king, I'll give you this money. What does the king say? He gives it to him. You can keep the money. He doesn't even want the money. What could he possibly have said to him? Is there something missing here? Or is it that accusations that have no basis in reality somehow, when it comes to us, resonate in the ears of people? Maybe I'll give you one more example. You know, in the Middle Ages, there was this accusation that was repeatedly leveled against us called the blood libel. Right? The accusation that the Jews murder Christian children either just as some form of religious ritual or often... What?
Or just because.
Just because, or to use their... No, but to... Or to use their blood for some sort of... To use to bake the blood into the matzot or whatever it is. Now, it's clear that there's absolutely not a shred of truth to that accusation, but that didn't stop the fact that time after time after time after time, this worked. And Jews were massacred because people believed it. And not only hundreds of years ago. It was done in Damascus only in the 1840, that's not so long ago. And not only that, but it's still being done. And statements like this are still being said, or things that are not all that different. I found a number of years ago a newspaper article from Sweden. I found that on the internet. Where they actually, this was published, the source of it may have been the Palestinian Authority, but it wasn't published in, if it was published in Palestinian press, this was published in a newspaper in Sweden. That there had been a Jew in New York about 5 years ago who was arrested, or a group of Jews in New York that had connections with Israel, and they were running this illegal organ trafficking operation, which is a crime, and not, right? They were basically selling human organs. But what they were doing was, in other words, arranging kidney transplants where the recipient pays the donor, which is illegal, instead of giving it to the person who needs it, whatever it is. And okay, so that's not nice, and it's a crime. But this Swedish newspaper used this as an opportunity, and they published an article, a lengthy article, in which they claimed... It happened to be that around the same time, Ehud Olmert, who at the time was prime minister, they were pushing to have Israelis sign organ donor cards. There's a shortage of of organs for human transplants here in Israel, and the prime minister made a thing, and he himself signed a donor card, and it was, right? So they took these two news articles, right? Here in Israel, there's a shortage of organs, and we have Jews with Israeli connections in New York who are selling organs, and what did the article say? That the Israeli army has been systematically kidnapping Palestinians, and that there's a phenomenon across the West Bank where Palestinian young people are disappearing and being brought home and buried in the middle of the night, and then when they dig up the bodies, they find that they've been cut open and all their organs are taken out, and the Israelis are... Is that anything different than the blood libel?
No.
It's a little modernized, right? Instead of using blood to make matzahs, we're killing people and murdering them to steal their organs. But it was a little bit havanit chakma, right? They used the fact that there was an unfortunate incident where, you know, there was some criminals who were doing something nowhere near that bad. Something bad, but nowhere near that. The guy got 2.5 years in jail, sechikol. Meaning, I'm not justifying what he did. I'm just saying, you know, there's no connection between the crime. So, and this is in a newspaper in Sweden. Sweden's not, I don't know if the Swedes are, I've never been to Sweden, but, you know, it's not known as, they are, you know, particularly anti-Semitic?
No.
Really? More than, let's say, half of Europe? Or just as much as half of Europe?
There are lots of Muslims there that become anti-Semitic.
Okay. But then but the point is, it's not a specific phenomenon that you can point
to.
No, but nowadays, Malmo, there are like 100,000 Muslims.
Okay. But even if it's Muslims, the fact that they're Muslims doesn't explain why such things resonate with them.
You don't want Muslims fighting you in your own country, do you, if you say nice things about Israel?
No, I understand that. But all I'm saying is you're pointing out the fact that today, perhaps, you know, anti-Semitism, you know, for whatever reasons we could analyze, perhaps today anti-Semitism is a little bit more... finds a little bit more fertile ground in Muslim communities than in Christian communities, perhaps. Whereas maybe in the Middle Ages it was the opposite, mm-hmm. perhaps. But the phenomenon is still universal. And the fact that accusations, absurd accusations like this can be accepted, right? So we're seeing this universal phenomenon. Where's it coming from? I have here an article from 1966 that was written by Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Zatzal, and the younger brother of Rav Yosef Soloveitchik. He's in Chicago at the time. And maybe he wasn't even in Chicago, maybe he was still in New York, but Ivan Soloveitchik, who later went to Chicago, who makes the following, I'm going to just read a few sentences. Our sages say, and this is what I would have quoted if we had the shiur in Parshat Vayishlach, right, when Yaakov wrestled with the representative Esav, it says, Halacha hi biyadua, She'esav soneli Yaakov, right? It's a halacha, as it were. It's a law of nature. She'esav soneli Yaakov, or other sources call it a halacha l'Moshe miSinai. Our sages say, says Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, that it is a halacha l'Moshe miSinai, a decree handed down from Mount Sinai, which he says here in a footnote simply means that it's built into the fabric of truth. It's an axiom that Esav hates Yaakov. One cannot explain on the basis of psychological or sociological principles why there is such a deeply rooted inherent prejudice in the heart and mind of every non-Jew, be it the best of them, against Jews. It cannot be explained. It is a fact. And he goes on and he says, I'll skip a little bit, the Midrash Rabbah does not mean halacha l'Moshe miSinai she'Hitler yamach shemo sone liyakov. Do we need to resort to this source to find out that Hitler was a Jew hater? Or that Haman was a Jew hater? The Midrash points to Esav in the generic sense. Whoever is a descendant of Esav, be he the saintliest among the Hasidei Umot HaOlam, has an innate prejudice against the Jews. And he goes on and describes his understanding of the Aaron Soloveitchik, that every non-Jew harbors in his heart a hatred of non-Jews, even those who act kindly towards us. And he talks here also about Thomas Masaryk, who has a street named after him up the road here, right? He calls me as one of the Hasidei Umot HaOlam, who, here, I'll read the sentence, asked by the French correspondent whether in his heart he entertained any prejudice against the Jews. Masaryk gave him the very honest answer. In my mind, I do not have any prejudice against the Jews. Whenever I feel that I'm under the impact of pure logic, Then I realized that the Jew should not be disliked. The Jew is as human as anyone else, and he was a chassid umot olam, he helped us. But sometimes, he admits, when the control of logic of the mind loosens and I fall prey to my feeling, then I take notice of the fact that deep in my heart there is a prejudice raging against the Jews. Why? I do not know. This was the answer that was given by Thomas Masaryk, and this is the reason why our sages apply the expression Halacha l'Moshe miSinai she'esav soneh l'Yaakov. So this is Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's understanding of it, that it's something irrational, it's something that cannot be explained, and that it's universal, that every single non-Jew harbors a hatred of the Jew. I certainly am not one to argue with Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. That's almost absurd, but L'fi aniyut dati, or to borrow a Talmudic expression, lule demistafina, if I would be so bold, I would suggest a slightly different way of looking at it. I'm not convinced, first of all, I am convinced that it's a universal phenomenon, in the sense that it always exists in every time and place where Am Yisrael exists. I don't know if that means it has to exist in the heart of every single person. And I'm not convinced personally that that's the case. And I'm also not convinced that just because it's universal and just because it's unique, that it has to be irrational and unexplainable. And perhaps there's another way to look at it. It is certainly universal. We've seen that. Wherever Am Yisrael exists, someone opposes us. And that is not true of anyone else. It's true that there are other groups who are hated. You know, black people have often been hated. But that doesn't mean that they're always hated everywhere. And other groups as well have often been hated and have often suffered terribly. But it's not universal. It's not that it never can be solved. Hatred of the Jew is universal. And that's certainly what Chazal meant by Halacha hi she'esav soneh l'Yaakov. But perhaps it can be understood and it can be explained. Am Yisrael, and here if we go back, those who were here when we learned Parshat Lech Lecha, we talked about this. Am Yisrael came into the world for a purpose. Avram Avinu was chosen and told, Lech Lecha me'artzecha mimolad mi'beit avicha, for a reason. Avram Avinu was chosen in order to make an impact on the world, to bring messages to the world. He represents something. Abraham and his descendants represent something. Back in Parsha Bereishit, it was called V'nivrechu v'cha kol mishpachot ha'adama. You're going to bring the messages of the blessings of God to the entire world. But the blessings of God also comes with the messages of God. Later on at Har Sinai, and I think we mentioned this also in Parshat Lech Lecha, later on at Har Sinai, the descendants of Abraham stood there and were told, V'atem tihiuli mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh. A nation of Kohanim, a Kohen, a priest, is someone who leads, a form of a leader, a spiritual leader, a religious leader. A Kohen, we have Kohanim among us, whose job it is to help us. Well, if I want to bring a Korban to the Beit HaMikdash, I do so. But at a certain point, I have to hand the Korban over to the Kohen, and he's the one who puts the Kohen, who puts the Korban on the Mizbeach. And when Hashem wants to send somebody as a messenger to raise his hands and bring his bracha to us, it's that same Kohen. Right? The Kohen is the one who leads us and teaches us and brings us to God and brings God to us. And Am Yisrael, that's the role of Am Yisrael in the world. V'atem tiyuli mamlechet Kohanim. And this we did do back then in Parshat Lech Lecha. We looked at Psukim in Yeshayahu, the vision of Acharit Hayamim in Yeshayahu, where he sees the entire world coming to Yerushalayim, Menaharu Elav Kol Goyim. All nations of the world, this is the ultimate purpose, the ultimate goal of history, that the entire world will come to Yerushalayim and say, L'chu v'nale el har Hashem el beit elokei Yaakov v'chule. We have a, Am Yisrael, whether we like it or not, has a mission. And we represent something. And that mission, that message that we represent, is certainly in the interest of the world. Ultimately, it's going to bring about the redemption of the world. But it's also a message that's hard to hear. Because belief in God and service of God means responsibility. And it means a certain amount of limitation. And it means people having to submit to the rule of something greater than themselves. And human beings naturally resist such a message. And we're the messenger. Whether we like it or not, we're the messenger. And I think what's happening is that opposition to Am Yisrael, and it's universal in the sense that it always exists, but I don't think one has to say what Rav Aaron did, that it's universal in the heart of every person. But when it does exist, I believe that opposition to Am Yisrael is really opposition to what Am Yisrael represents. Now, we don't necessarily always want to represent that. And very often, what we try to do is simply blend into the woodwork. I don't mean we in the narrow sense of the people sitting in this room. I mean we in the broad sense of Am Yisrael. We very much have this tendency that we want to try to... we carry a heavy burden. What do they used to say in Yiddish? Se shver zu sein Yid. Right? It's a hard thing. It's a hard thing to always be forced to be a leader of this type. And many times we try to avoid it. And many times we call it assimilation. It's a fancy modern word for a phenomenon that's also fairly universal. That Am Yisrael always wants to be just like everybody else, more than other people do. I remember when I lived in Muncie, I lived in a neighborhood which there are many such neighborhoods in Muncie, which was almost entirely Orthodox Jews. Within blocks and blocks and blocks of my house, the overwhelming majority, probably upwards of 95% of the people, were Orthodox Jews, and most of those who weren't were not, the few others, most of those who weren't Orthodox Jews were still Jews. And here and there was one or two goyim that still lived there, hadn't yet sold their houses and moved out. And it happened to be this one house, I never met the guy, a few blocks away from me. For those who know Muncie, Route 306 is like a major road there, and I'm right on the corner of Route 306, and I forgot which side street. There was this one guy who was clearly not Jewish, and who clearly wanted him, you know, around, it started Halloween time, a few weeks before Halloween, you know, people put out these decorations in Chutz La'aretz, but this guy put out decorations, I mean, his entire, I don't know how much money he spent, there were dead people, there were skeletons, there were lanterns, there were, right, and as soon as that passed, then the Christmas decorations went up, but I'm talking about, I guess I'd be exaggerating a little bit if I said it rivaled Rockefeller Center, but only a little bit. I don't know how many megawatts of electricity that guy needed. He had a nativity scene. He had Santa Claus and the elves. He had, like, the whole head. You could see it from blocks away. You know, lights flashing. It was mugzam biyoter. And to me, I never met the guy. At the time, I was a teacher in Muncie, and I had a student who lived a few houses down from him. She said he was a really nice guy. Got along great with his neighbors. He was the Shabbos guy. And to me, it was very clear what he was doing. I never met him, so I'm speculating, but it seemed very clear to me. He wanted to make clear what his identity was. You know, he was very different than all the people among whom he lived. I'm imagining that had he lived in a different neighborhood, he might not have felt the need to put so much effort into it, but he wanted to declare his identity. He's a Christian, and there aren't too many Christians around here. So I don't know if he was religious even. I don't know if this was like a religious thing, he wanted to spread the word, or it was just a pride thing. And according to the people who knew him, it wasn't that he was doing it. It was an antagonistic thing. He wasn't against them. He just wanted to proclaim his own identity. So I asked my students back then, high school girls that I was teaching, I said, when there's one Jew who's in his situation, the Chanukiah, how prominent is it usually?
Not too,
if it's there at all, right? Why is that? Right? Because he has a healthy self-image, that guy. He has an identity, and he's comfortable with who he is. And so often a Jew isn't because being a Jew is a heavy burden. And perhaps because we've been conditioned by thousands of years of history to know what this burden, the price that we sometimes have to pay for this burden. So we have a tendency to want to try to deny it and to want to try to sort of blend into the woodwork and avoid it. But if there's one thing that history teaches, it's that doesn't work. Because they'll always figure out who we are. And the one thing that the Jews will never be allowed to be is just like everybody else. That simply is also a fact of history. That's what Theodor Herzl learned when he sat in the trial of Alfred Dreyfus and turned him from an assimilationist into the founder of Zionism, for example, or of political Zionism. And therefore, and if you talk to non-Jews, by the way, most people, I don't know if most people, I get the sense from time to time that a lot of people in the world understand this a lot more than we do. And that the only people who don't see sometimes, perhaps, how significant we are, is we ourselves. But I'll close with two stories and a final comment. Two stories that both happened right next to the holiest place in the world. One positive and one negative. I remember once being at the Kotel. And before I got involved in tourism, I was just there. And it was a group of Christian pilgrims, I guess, there. And from somewhere in the States. And some man came over to me, you know, wearing those badges that the tourists wear, speaking with an accent that betrayed his Midwestern U.S. Origin. And he asked me if I spoke English, and I said I did. And he started talking to me, and he asked me where I live, and I told him that I live here in Israel. He said, "You live here?" I said, "Well, not here. I don't live at the Western Wall, and I don't even live in Jerusalem. I live nearby." And he gave me this whole speech about how we're God's chosen people and how this is the holiest place in the world. I'm sitting here listening. He wouldn't let me go. And he gave me this whole speech, you know, praising the role that we have to, I guess he was an evangelical Christian. I know there's a debate about whether we should take what they say at face value or not at face value, but it certainly sounded very nice, right? And I wanted to say, you know, tell it to that guy over there. And like, you know, he sees something that we don't see. And that's true when it's positive, but it's also true when it's a negative. And with this story, I'll close. I may have quoted this once. I have a tendency to tell the same story. So if I've said this once before in this forum, please forgive me. But it's worth repeating. I have a friend who lives, a neighbor who lives in Gush Etzion, who comes from, it's Baal Tshuva, comes from a non-observant background. And oftentimes it's worth listening to people who see things from a slightly different angle. Years ago, shortly after he made Aliyah, and not that long after he became religious, he went on he went up to Har HaBayit with a group that was going up to Har HaBayit. And I'm sure you all know that there's this absurd situation here, where, in my mind, absolutely unconscionable situation, where the Israeli government, which theoretically controls Har HaBayit, enforces, you know, the wishes of the Muslim authorities, and when Jews go up to Har HaBayit, they're not permitted to pray there, and there are people following you around, and a policeman, if they catch your lips moving and muttering some tefillot under your breath, you could be arrested or at least removed from the mountain, etc. And it's on, you know, I get very upset by that thing, as many people do, but this was, and he also did, but this was his take. He wasn't focusing on the what I think is an avla, the injustice of the fact that the Israeli government gives in to those demands. He looked at the demands himself. This was during the Intifada, the second Intifada, when there were suicide bombings and all sorts of terrible things were going on, and I think it might have been after Ariel Sharon, after Mitzach HaMat Magen, those who remember the war. And he said, you know, this was his take on the Muslims up there, you know, who are enforcing this. He said, they're not afraid of our tanks or our fighter jets or our nuclear weapons, but they're afraid of our tefillah. For some reason, he said to me, like, do you really care what they say when they pray there in Al-Aqsa? And I said, not really. Does it bother you? Are you worried what they're saying in there? Let's say I told you that they're praying to God to destroy you. Do you care? I said, no. But apparently they do. And that was such a tremendous insight. I don't know how many of us think that our tefillot have any real significance. But they do. And they're willing to take such great efforts to prevent us. Sakako, what was I going to do? Apparently, somebody out there thinks that our tefillot matter. And maybe we should listen. Maybe we should listen to them. Maybe we have something to learn even from our enemies. And therefore, I'll close with the following line. Many years ago, when I was one of the directors of New Jersey NCSY, I worked with a fellow named Gershon Steinberg, who once ran a program on anti-Semitism that was designed geared towards kids from less observant backgrounds, and his soundbite was, if you want to fight anti-Semitism, be a Semite. Meaning if we're right that all of this that began already in the days of the Plishtim and Paro and continues to this day is really about an attempt, a subconscious attempt perhaps, to stop our message from being heard, then the solution is to work even harder for the message to be heard, and to realize that this very uncomfortable phenomenon is really an indication of the fact that we have something very, very, very significant that we represent. And the solution, if there is one, is to represent that and to work together to bring about the vision of Yeshayahu as quickly as possible. Because Yeshayahu tells us that the day will come that, in fact, this will eventually end. Perhaps only then. But therefore, if we can make that happen, b'mehera v'yameinu, so then that's the solution. Amen.